This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeline Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Cognoggins and Clockwork. What makes good steampunk?
So as we announced previously on our Facebook page, today's episode is to celebrate 1,000 downloads. And so we opened up a guest spot and we are pleased to announce that with us here today, we have Amelia McKenzie. Amelia is a MA creative writing student from the University of Winchester, whose dissertation was specializing in steampunk fiction. So nice to have you on with us, Amelia.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
So can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your research?
Yeah, you summed it up pretty succinctly, I think. I studied creative writing at University of Winchester, and then I did the MA for writing for children there as well, graduating this autumn. And my dissertation for my master's was in steampunk, specifically steampunk for teenagers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did lots of like research into where it came from, like with Victorian fiction initially, and then into sort of the 70s and 80s when it became its own genre and wasn't just sort of science fiction. It was now its own thing, into what it is now.
Brilliant. And you also wrote a book to go with it.
I did a book.
Tell us a bit about the book, please.
The book, its working title at the moment is Ars Moriendi, which is very poncy, posh Latin for The Art of Dying, which it makes sense when you've read it. It's they have little steampunk magic items in it that are called the Ars Moriendi, which is why it's called that. And it's about a 16-year-old girly girl in a sort of pseudo-Victorian Britain who's she finds this brooch, which is one of the Ars Moriendi. Spoilers!
Spoilers for chapter one, great!
Yeah, right. And it's haunted by this sort of like ghostly hologram man. Gwen, being Gwen, is terrified and wants nothing to do with this adventure, and she turns it off and she shuts it in a drawer and she hopes at the end of it, and it's not. And her family is attacked and she's dragged off on this adventure.
The line,
yeah, I was very proud of my line in my pitch, which is kicking her high heels and screaming her corset off. It was great fun to write, and I love it.
I've had the advantage over Jules in that I've actually read this work of art. I've been reading Ars Moriendi for quite a while. I sort of badgered Amelia into sending it to me, and I read it the whole way through. And then when she sent me the last chapter, I finished reading it, and it was only when I finished the last chapter I thought, oh wait, this is the end. And Amelia point blank actually told me that was it. She was only going to write one. It was not going to actually have any sequels. And I think the proudest thing I've ever done is that I started kind of suggesting things to Amelia, like, oh, have you ever had a sequel? You could do this. And Amelia was like, no, no, no. And then after a while, she was there like, well, if there was a sequel, yeah, I could do that or the other. And then the other day, she replies saying, yeah, this is going to happen. And she said, and that would happen in the sequel. And I'm like, not if there's a sequel, there's going to be a sequel now. And she was there like, no!
You broke me.
I did. I broke her. I convinced her. And now there may be a sequel.
There may be. It's all dependent on, you know, what happens with the first one. But yeah, I'd be willing to now.
Yes!
I think it's going to be co-written by Madeline at this point.
But Ars Moriendi is currently being considered by an agent, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I've not got my hopes too high at the moment, because I do know there are still flaws with it that I'd like to correct, and I wouldn't be surprised if she came back and those flaws were the reasons that she wasn't willing to represent it. But you know, it'll be exciting if she comes back and says yes. You'll get some very excited messages on Facebook.
Well, best of luck. Best of luck with that.
Thank you.
So today's episode is a little bit about steampunk, and we're going to be looking at what makes steampunk steampunk, and it's not just the cogs. And we're going to be looking at whether steampunk always has to be set in the Victorian era and why it so often is.
And I think that's a good place to start, is the seemingly indissoluble link between Victorian London and steampunk. So, Amelia, do you want to pitch in on that since you did your dissertation on it?
Oh, no, I've got to sound professional now.
No pressure.
I think steampunk in its like when it was created, sort of almost the creators didn't know they were creating it when they did, but it came from writers like H.G. Wells, Jules Verne, H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah, Edgar Rice Burroughs, maybe.
That's
I
a
mean, would you even consider Frankenstein to almost be?
Yeah, I guess in some ways it kind of is, because it's using kind of Victorian technology to create, like a fantastical sort of idea. So yeah, I it could be a very it kind of a little tenuous maybe.
It's
It's
like
kind
it's like
of style.
pre-steampunk, isn't it?
Yeah. I think at the time when they were writing them, they were called scientific romance. These stories that and it's kind of what seemed to happen was almost like a nostalgia kick, like years and years down the line, people went, oh, that goofy Victorian sci-fi where they thought like alien war machines would be powered by steam engines. That's so funny. Let's do that again. And yeah, it's like this whole subculture built out of it. But I think it was the invention of it coming from like a Victorian starting point has got it kind of like people think they can't be torn apart now. It's the technology comes with Victoriana.
Yeah, I mean, it's very reflective of the time when you were coming towards the end of the Industrial Revolution. Everything was new, and the new things were coming in and changing everyone's way of life. The railways had got a lot better. And then also, you had things like, people were being put out of work by these more efficient factory machines and things. And that had been happening for the previous century, obviously, but it had got to the point where you were starting to have things like the Great Exhibition in London. And I think that was a sort of a turning point when it became sort of fashionable to be informed about science and about technology, and it was a shunning of the more, if you like, spiritual and supernatural elements, the superstitious elements of life.
Well, I think another aspect of that was that previously to that, the supernatural aspects of that they were very obsessed with, were an answer to this idea that with magic anything was possible. And now suddenly the idea of science was the new magic, as it were. And with science, anything was now possible, but they were still limited by only what they could see. So you have these machines that can travel through time, but they're powered like, trains,
And in fact, I mean, the Victorians were obsessed with the paranormal as well, and that feeds into steampunk a lot, where you get a lot of steampunk stories where, there's this wonderful technology and everything, and then there's also ghosts and demons and things. A very obscure mention, but there's a steampunk book, I think the first one I ever read as a teenager, called The Haunting of Elazabeth Cray. Really, really steampunk. It's all they've got like, it's set Victorianish times, but half of London's been overwhelmed by demons, and the story's about like fighting demons and fighting ghosts and stuff. And it's weird almost, because if you think science fiction, you don't tend to think ghosts.
You don't, but then obviously in the Victorian era, spiritualism, which was what was coming up in the latter age of the Victorian era, was actually considered a science or a scientific practice. Obviously, most people wouldn't nowadays consider it a scientific practice.
Now,
So.
speaking of the merger between science and the supernatural, that does bring to mind a series that's been out recently, and that's Penny Dreadful,
Yes.
which I would definitely consider has steampunk elements. But interestingly enough, its focus is not science based. It's all about the supernatural, and they've got a lot of supernatural things going on.
Yeah,
And yet
absolutely.
the very modern tone that sort of makes it so rapid is almost what gives it that steampunk element.
It's
you
almost
know.
Yeah, yeah, it's almost like the supernatural sort of based upon a scientific basis. Because if you think about it, the main character is basically being hunted by every evil entity from here to kingdom come because they all want to use her. But they, when people try to treat her, they don't go for exorcism as such. In fact, does she really want it anyway? But that's a different question. It's you know, she how much time does she spend in mental institutes and undergoing experimental procedures like lobotomies and things like that?
Oh yeah, the good old Victorian mental asylum.
Yeah.
That comes into steampunk a lot as well.
Again, it's sort of, well, we'd say pseudoscience now, but was considered science at the time. I mean, the fact that you could strap somebody to what is effectively a ducking stool and stick them into ice cold water because assuming a seizure was a sign that their brain had got too hot is not considered a scientific way of treating somebody nowadays, thank goodness. But it was a common practice for mental wards, particularly women's mental wards at the time.
Yeah, why did women always have it worse?
You know why.
I know why.
But it was also the farcical belief that the womb moved around the body. And
yes, migrated.
Yeah. Migrated around. What was it? They were also concerned when cars came into... No, it was trains. When trains started getting popular, they were concerned that... The women weren't going to be able to, that women were not designed to travel at that speed and that it would, you know, destroy our fragile bodies.
Oh gosh, yeah. I did some research into Victorian mental asylums. Madeline, you'll remember because you were on Facebook to me, I think, at the time.
Yes.
For Ars Moriendi. And gosh, the practices in them were horrendous. It was torture, essentially.
Yes, and you didn't necessarily have to have a mental illness to be sent there. You just had to be unwed and pregnant, or an unwanted daughter or mother-in-law or somebody.
Or to be in way of someone's inheritance.
Yes.
Yes, yeah.
Anyway, we're going off topic.
Yeah. Let's go back to H.G. Wells, because he's a really good example of the dawning of steampunk, I think.
Yeah. Now, The Time Machine, interestingly enough, if we compare the movie to the book, they're a little bit different. And certainly...
Which movie?
Oh gosh, was there more
there's
than
two.
One? Is there two?
I think there's actually about four or five. There's some more black and whites as well. No, for the more recent.
The movie itself feels more sort of visually, the way they've made it visually, is a lot more sci-fi, I found, than it was steampunk. Whereas the book, again, because it was written in the era, or maybe because I've been tainted by my assumptions of it before I went into it, felt very steampunk because it was very trapped in that Victorian sort of timeline, whereas the movie almost betrayed that in some ways. Am I the only one who feels that?
Well, yeah, it did try very hard to capture a more scientific basis. It started bringing in things like laws of physics that weren't discovered or weren't theorised until much, much later. Whereas in the book, it is very much a case of he pulls a lever and they go back in time.
Yes.
That is the technology.
I found the interesting thing with the Time Machine movie as well was, I don't know if it was in the book, the protagonist is very forward-thinking.
Yeah.
For that era. I clearly remember him saying something about he wanted to run down the high street in London and knock all the bowler hats off everyone's heads. And that seems to be a thing with steampunk, is you take the trappings of the Victorian era, but the perspective of...
a modern person.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's always a really interesting that they have a protagonist who's very forward-thinking, but if it's a female protagonist, they're quite often wedded to being considered quite proper. Now, whether that's because it's a societal trapping... But they're not, you know, while they're being quite forward thinking, they're not quite, most of them aren't willing to wear trousers and get rid of their corsets kind of thing.
But at the same time, it's the odd thing, which is that a forward thinking woman in the Victorian era is always overly sexualised as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're the only one who noticed that.
Yeah, I think at Victorian times that would not do well for you.
I just don't understand how you can't be forward thinking without also wanting to rip off your clothes at any conceivable moment. Apparently those two don't go hand in hand in fiction, but hey oh.
What do you mean, Maddie? You mean you don't feel that way?
Bad news for you, Amelia.
No.
No, going back to the Time Machine, in the book he is actually very much a product of his era. He's forward thinking in the sense of he's much more wedded to science and reason and logic, but it's almost a cautionary tale, like most of H.G. Wells' stories actually are. And he's a very proper British gentleman, ultimately. Once you scratch the surface and get through this progressive layer, mm-hmm. he is still sort of like pocket watch and waistcoat, and we have yeah. high tea at a certain time.
And it's the same, actually. I don't know if you guys saw the recent movie of Around the World in 80 Days.
Is that the one with Jackie Chan?
Yeah, I mean, it was yeah. hilarious.
I loved it, yeah.
I think the only thing it shared with the book was the title. some of the characters' names. It was a great movie. I loved the movie. But the concept of the movie was that it was this inventor who was very forward-thinking. He was a bit ditzy, but he was very forward-thinking, and he was a very modern person. Whereas actually in the book, he's as Victorian as they come. Now in the film, he's just there like, fine, I will take this wager, but not for money. It is for, you know, for the good of science. Whereas in the book, he's like, of course I will take this wager, and it will be for money. What kind of gentleman would I be if I didn't? And he's literally the total opposite of how they decide to depict him in the movies. And I still quite enjoyed the book. It was. For some of the amazing things that were happening in it, it was quite dull. But anyway,
well, I find Victorian fiction tends to be a lot more slow paced, which is something that steampunk's picked up on, because steampunk tends to be adventure,
yeah,
and fast paced. But I think if we look at the word steampunk onto itself, the word steampunk obviously was not introduced in the Victorian era. It came about much later, and it wasn't just to do with fiction. It was almost to do with a certain culture. And we look at it, and its steam is obviously in reference to steam power. But punk, I think punk onto itself tells us a little bit about what the genre is.
Yeah, this is where my dissertation comes in handy, because I can tell you who invented the word.
Ooh, please.
It was K.W. Jeter, or Jetta. I'm not sure how to pronounce the name. I've only ever seen it written. Along with Michael Moorcock.
Can you tell us a little bit about it?
It was a part of a discussion they were having about this new revolutionary in the 70s, I think, new revolutionary genre that was coming up. And K.W. Jeter said that he thought that it would be the next big thing if only they could come up with a nice snazzy name for it, and then said, like steampunk, perhaps, and managed to come up with a snazzy name on the spot.
That's very enviable.
Yeah, right. They started a whole
genre.
But yeah, it is, and it's very much a youth subculture as well as a genre of fiction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was a member of, a sort of honorary member of Southampton Steampunk Society for a couple of years. And there was a book club as part of it, but the majority of the things we did were not to do with literature. It was the costume and the mannerisms and the history and everything. We went and visited I can't remember the name of the ship now. Yeah, we went and visited Isambard Kingdom Brunel's ship, and all sort of looked into the engineering and stuff. But yeah, it encompasses a lot.
There's a word you pull up, which is a very interesting one, which is engineering.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can talk about the science side of things of steampunk, but actually I think the real core of steampunk is engineering. It tends to be, I mean, we joked about the whole put cogs into it, and it's steampunk.
Yeah.
but there is an element of truth to that, which is that engineering and that, the design is the core part of how we imagine steampunk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very much so. If you've ever been to MCM Expo's steampunk exhibit that they, a few years ago, I don't know if they still have it, but they do it every year. It is full of all of these modern things that we have now, like a toaster or something that they've tried to make with, or at least look like it runs on cogs and steam power.
Brilliant.
And it's incredible.
I think that is almost the most interesting part of this culture, and I'm going to call it a culture now rather than a genre, is the ingenuity behind it. And I think that something that a lot of modern steampunk is trying to do is, now I'm going to talk about Sherlock Holmes here, the Guy Ritchie movies with Robert Downey Jr., which are fantastic.
Yes. Oh, yes.
His accent's terrible, but it's also, you know, These are great. I love the whole thing. I really do. I love it. And the way that they do science there is obviously they're trapped. They're trapped by the era that they're writing in. So they can't have, you know, microboards. I don't know what I'm talking about. No technological. Yeah. They don't have computers and chips or anything like that. Batteries for that matter. And yet they're trying to create all these amazing pieces of technology. And so they're merging these steampunk elements in with our current understanding of science, which is very interesting. Again, if we compare it to The Time Machine, which was written during the era or thereabouts, and we compare how they understood technology and how they did technology, you can really see where steampunk is kind of headed now. And it's almost like, actually, the more technologically advanced we get, the more steampunk is possible, because now we can make all of these amazing things and then revert them back to cogs and steam.
Yeah.
Because we understand how to make them. So
yeah.
Well, I mean, it's really interesting, as I was saying about the London exhibition. Obviously, it was to showcase various things from all over the world, but also to showcase what's new in technology. I mean, we still have exhibitions for that sort of thing today, but at the time it was something like a magical bazaar of things, and people would predict things that seemed so off the wall that nobody would believe that they'd ever be invented. Now imagine if you were showing your phone to someone in the Victorian era nowadays, which is basically a small computer in your hand. And now think about at the London exhibition, it was a woman who originally invented the basis for what we now use as computer code.
Oh,
and
yes.
It was showcased at the London exhibition. I think it was Ada Lovelace.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
Did they burn her as a witch?
No. I mean, the trouble is they didn't have the technology to really do anything with the code. They showcased it and they tried it with a few various different things, but you need certain equipment to make the equipment in order to make the computer to actually utilize the code. So it was a couple of centuries before its time, really.
Yes. I didn't have a point. I was just agreeing.
Oh, I thought you were going to tell us something amazing. Sorry.
Yeah, I did do a little research into Ada Lovelace, but not enough that I have anything particularly spectacular to say about her, besides that, yeah, she did create the basis for computer coding, and quite incredible considering there was no such thing as a computer back then.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there's also... Sorry, I just thought of a point. There's a thing in steampunk where you look at Victorian literature, and I remember being kind of freaked out as a kid when you find out that actually H.G. Wells got some things right.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's spooky.
The question is, did he get them right, or did he just inspire the next generation of scientists who then copied from his designs?
Yeah. There's a good likelihood.
Well, and then it's amazing when they get things spectacularly wrong.
Oh, yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Slightly off topic, but I mean, if you look at some of the sketches Leonardo da Vinci did of his flying machines and things like that, and actually he wasn't too far off with some of the physics.
Yeah.
And we predominantly know him as an artist, but he was a true Renaissance man.
Real engineer.
Anyway, one point I thought was really interesting, and it's noticeable to me in steampunk from the books I've read, and that's that it tends, with the progressive thinking, you tend to have perhaps the women aren't equals, but the women protagonists in it tend to be quite intelligent, and if not, they're trying to claim equality with their male counterparts. You also quite often have a fair bit of sexual diversity as well, I think. Has anyone else found that?
No, I definitely the female protagonists I've noticed are varied in their, like, the way they act. Thinking of Mortal Engines, there's two female protagonists in it, and they are the opposite ends of the spectrum. There's Hester, who's a complete tomboy, hair cut off, scarred face, wears trousers, and there's another girl in it as well who is very upper class, wears the long floaty dress, very girly, and fights her battles through intelligence and through sort of sneaky work rather than through punching things in the face like Hester does.
Yeah.
Whereas in Victorian fiction, I think that Hester as a character would have probably been seen as the villain.
Yeah,
I can imagine so. And I kind of get what you mean about sort of diversity of sexualities, but I wonder whether that isn't actually more to do with the audience that it's headed toward, that the steampunk as a genre now kind of adheres toward, than it's certainly not something we would have seen in work that would now be considered steampunk from the Victorian era, but current steampunk.
Oh no,
absolutely.
Current steampunk. Obviously, I don't mean H.G. Wells was writing about, you know, two gay male protagonists or anything, but
he might have been.
If you take a
secretly,
it would have been quite secret because it would have been illegal at the time. He would have got his books burnt, you know, rather like
Conan and Doyle managed to get away with it,
and all of his fans.
Only if you take a book, you take a book like The Watchmaker of Filigree Street by Natasha Pulley. Either of you read that one?
I've not. No.
That's an exceptionally good book, and it's very steampunk. I mean, the watchmaker obviously deals in clockwork, but he's much cleverer than that. There's all these political intrigues, and the bombs are set off with clockwork devices, and so that's interesting. I mean, you have to get fairly into it before you really get going. Your main character, Nathaniel, has a form of synesthesia, which is, again, also interesting. And he's bisexual, and it's not really thrown in your face. It's just a case of, as you get further into the book, you realise that the relationships he's built up with Grace and with the Watchmaker are actually friendships that could go either way. And the main plot of the book, as it turns out, is not a big political intrigue. That actually turns into the subplot and an interesting little twist halfway through. And the main point of the book is these two characters, Grace and the Watchmaker, who's a Japanese man who's been living in London for a long time and who is precognitive to a certain extent as well. I'm not doing the book justice at all here. Because
I'm really interested. It's
set up in such a way that you think, when you get to a point towards the end where you're thinking, yeah, but the Watchmaker probably saw that coming and that. And if he did that and acted in that way, I mean, we know he left Japan because he was going to meet Nathaniel and he wanted to have the opportunity to maybe get together with Nathaniel. Did he set everything up so that Grace was going to fail at this, etc.? And it's one of those ones that stays with you for a long time afterwards. It's very, very good. The main plot is about him trying to balance these two friendships and which person he's supposed to end up with.
Oh, wow.
And they're both willing to do some quite... Nathaniel's actually a really nice guy, a genuine, just nice guy. whereas the other two are sort of like, they're quite willing to be quite dastardly to get to win.
Twirl that moustache.
Yeah.
So now here's the question. Can we think of any examples of steampunk fiction which is not set in the Victorian or a Victorian equivalent era? Silence.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. The ones I can think that aren't set technically in Victorian London, or Victorian era at least, seem to be set in a world that has splintered off from Victorian
London. Yeah. I think I could... it depends what you... Because steampunk can be quite varied, and some people call something steampunk that... I mean, we've been saying about if you put cogs in it, it's steampunk. I know people would say, well, no, it's not. In that case, it's clockpunk. it's that bad, where, you know, there's steampunk and there's clockpunk and then there's dieselpunk, cyberpunk, and they get further and further from steampunk as they go along. But there's a movie about this little, like, this adorable, like, stitched teddy bear man fighting against these horrifying nightmare machines that, like, I was 16, 17, I think, when I first saw it, and I was like, I'm gonna have nightmares forever about this this PG movie. that's set in the distant future. It's set post-nuclear war, mm-hmm. and humanity's been wiped out, and the machines and this little, like, these little doll people are all that's left. And you could call I would call it steampunk. I've known other people who say that it's stitch punk. Yeah. That's the only thing I can think of, really, that's not only not Victorian set, but also not mimicking a Victorian setting, like Mortal Engines, although it's set in the future again. The societies are very Victorian in nature.
Well, I think there's also... Did you guys ever watch Treasure Planet?
Yes!
On Treasure Island. Now, a part of me feels that that is kind of steampunk, and
I'd say
the
so.
The reason we say it's steampunk is actually because of, again, it has this merger of old and the new. So they've got these ships, except they look like actual, you know, ships.
Yeah, tall ships.
Yeah, they've got these galleys in space. And so it feels very steampunk in that regard. And with that in mind, there's also several Japanese animations, the Studio Ghibli stuff, which again is not set in the Victorian era, but it tends to be set in a sort of a past or equivalent era. But it's not usually Victorian. Howl's Moving Castle is a fine example of that, and that has again supernatural elements to it. But it's not Victorian. It's much later on, actually.
It has a very steampunk feel, doesn't it? Particularly if you just look at the castle and it's like, it's powered by steam, clearly.
Yeah, it's literally powered by steam.
Yeah, it's like this steampunk Baba Yaga hut.
And then there's something of the valley. Oh, what's it
Nausicaa.
Called?
Nausicaa. Yeah. Nausicaa, Valley of the Wind. Yeah.
Though that might be more cyberpunkish.
I think that's slightly more that way. Because you do have that's like post major technological meltdown after. That's very post-apocalyptic.
Yeah, same with Akira and stuff like that. Yeah. But actually, the Japanese have got the steampunk down pretty well, to be honest. You see a lot of steampunk elements appearing in manga. I mean, there's a whole bunch of steampunk stuff that occasionally appears in Naruto.
Because
no one knows when the hell that's even set.
I was just thinking Final Fantasy VI.
Fantasy in general, to be honest.
Yeah, so they sort of vary between high fantasy, cyberpunk, and six is particularly steampunk. They're walking around in the very beginning in these like steam powered mech things, and that's God. I don't even know how old is Final Fantasy VI. That must be older.
Oh, that's what
late 70s, I think. Early 80s. Yeah, 80s. I think 80s.
80s. I don't think it's quite as far back as.
Yeah, 80s. But that's when the literary genre started, that they took that into video game making in Japan.
Yeah. I've got a couple of books that are perhaps, they take some, they're not actually set in Victorian London, which is, you know, a good start. They're both indie authors, but they're really worth checking out. First is Dave Robinson, and it's his Doc Vandal series, and it's pure Edgar Rice Burroughs meets Ryder G. Haggard, but with a steampunk twist. And it's this, the main character, Doc Vandal, was orphaned and then brought up by this colony of sort of clockwork mechanoids on the moon alone. So he hasn't learned how to interact with people.
No.
And when he makes it back to Earth, he's like highly intelligent, very analytical. He's like Sherlock Holmes without the sociopath factor. He's a great adventurer, and he's got this sort of agency that goes around sorting out problems no one else can. And there's a sentient gorilla who gets paid in bananas, and it's absolutely fantastic.
Wow.
And it's funny and it's light. It doesn't take itself too seriously, but it also sort of challenges preconceptions and things. And I'm not just saying this because I vaguely know Dave Robinson, and he very kindly gave me copies of his books to read and review. I mean, obviously, if you give me free books, it will favourably dispose me towards you, but they still have to be good books.
Hashtag not sponsored.
Hashtag not sponsored. So the first one's The Eldest Flame, and there's sort of zombies and all sorts in it, but it is very much steampunk. The other one is another author I know just a little bit through talking on Goodreads, and that's Kara Jorgensen, and she has the Earl of Brass series, and they're actually not set in Victorian times, they're set in sort of Regency England.
Ooh. Ooh.
So technology's a little bit further ahead, and you've got things like steam-powered brass limbs and things like that.
Another thing we'll talk about, but sort of steam-powered limbs.
I was just thinking Cinder, actually, which it maybe leans more towards cyberpunk, but it's it's kind of steampunk Cinderella.
Yeah.
In which the glass slipper that she loses in the fairy tale is actually a leg. She's got a steampunk leg.
Sorry, Jules, continue.
No, that's okay. They're definitely worth reading. I think she's working on the fourth book at the moment. It's the Earl of Brass, the Winter Garden, and the Earl and the Artificer, and they have got classic steampunk elements, so you have technology that is supported by clockwork and steam. You have things like zeppelins for transport, but
love zeppelins.
So you have all the mores and morals and things that you'd find in a sort of Jane Austen type novel.
They're
just really, really good fun. But again, with more modern steampunk, you've also got gay relationships, slightly more progressive sexual relationships between characters, in the sense of, you know, we're not waiting till we get married.
Yeah.
Which would have been social suicide in Regency England.
God, yeah.
In fact, that would have been social suicide up until about the 60s, if not a bit longer.
Yeah. Depending where you are, it could still be suicide.
Yes. So those two, not necessarily set in Victorian London, they're the ones I can think of, and they're worth checking out. And I think this is part of the thing, isn't it? The ones that get to agents and publishers that seem to follow paths that have been trodden a little bit before, because they don't want to take too big a risk at the moment.
Yeah.
Whereas you've got two indie authors here who've done something a bit different, and they probably wouldn't get picked up by agents, or the publishers would say, oh, we're not sure about that, that looks a bit risky.
Yeah, it is. It is the trouble with traditional publishing, is you've got to get this balance between, they, you know, they do say they want stuff that's new and original and different.
But they don't.
But yeah, but they do, but they don't. But it's like they want it, but it's also got to be something that they can easily sell. Like, you've got to be able to come up with a tagline for it and sell it under this thing. And
it's not just that, but they want it, but you've got to send it to them at the right phase of the moon.
Oh God,
they've got to pick it up when they've just had their morning coffee and, you know,
after you've sacrificed
surprise.
A goat.
Yeah.
Or a loved one.
Loved one, goat, same difference.
But, I mean, that's not to do down anybody who wants to write steampunk set in Victorian London, because there's still legs on that, like a centipede that hasn't been done to death, in my opinion.
No,
I was going to say, I'm feeling great authors. Bad, because
No.
It's very much set in Victorian London.
No, I love it. I love Victorian London as a setting. I probably
well,
would use
though.
It
Wales
myself.
Well.
Oh, yeah, Wales and France as well. Steampunk France.
I can see steampunk Paris, actually.
Yeah, that would. Oh, the sequel, Madeline. Write it down.
Yes.
It could be full of ennui and clockwork that is only switched on 4 days every week. Sorry, stereotyping.
It's not run on steam, it's run on cigarette smoke. I'm allowed to say that, I'm French. Anyway, but I think going back, what Jules' description of the books, again, highlights another great aspect of steampunk, which is that we talk about it being sort of representative for the sexes and stuff like that. But that is another huge thing that happens in steampunk, and it's artificial limbs. And you've got a lot of characters who are amputees, and you don't see that kind of stuff actually in a lot of other sort of fiction. You just don't.
When you do, it tends to be censored when it's changing it. Like, I'm thinking of The Hunger Games, where Peter has his leg amputated at the end of the first book, and in the film.
Particularly American-made films, they take that sort of stuff out because there is a genuine resistance against anything that... I mean, Katniss at the end of the third film should have been a patchwork of half-grown pink skin stitched to old skin that was burnt, and she should not have been looking good. She shouldn't be going on with flawless makeup in a lovely red suit that had just been fitted for her. She was an absolute psychological and physical mess by the end of it, as you would be.
Yeah.
But they don't like that as a visual. That doesn't... Perhaps that just doesn't sell.
Don't talk about the war.
Yeah. Which makes me wonder, because I've heard whispers of, when are we getting a Cinder film and everything. I wonder how they would even go about doing it if they're so reluctant to have artificial limbs, prosthetics.
But see, that's the thing. It's they seem to be able to do it with steampunk. And I think it's because when you look at artificial limbs in steampunk, they're just cool, aren't they?
Yeah.
Like...
And so it kind of distracts from... And I think there's a... I knew a girl in my philosophy class, and she... I think she was either born without her arm or she lost it when she was quite young. And for the most part, she didn't wear a fake hand or anything like that, though she did actually have a really well-made one that was clearly very expensive and looked very realistic. And then later on, she was actually a swimmer. And I think if you look her up, her name is Jojo. And she later on got this amazing prosthetic, which was hollow on the inside of the wrist and had a fake snake twirling in and out, so it looked like it was dipping under her skin. It looks really
cool.
It was from a designer who designed these prosthetics. And again, they were works of art rather than just a prosthetic. And suddenly people weren't concentrating on the fact she didn't have an arm. They were concentrating on how cool her prosthetic was. And that's becoming a real thing, which is great. It's really fantastic. It's becoming a real thing at the moment. And I think that that is almost, steampunk has kind of been doing that for a while already. It's taking away from the lack of something and saying, we've got this. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It doesn't have to mimic what you don't have. It's just being its own thing.
Yeah. I mean, when was the last time you saw a steampunk arm that was just an arm? Like, it's nobody got lasers attached or something.
It's like, as you were saying about Cinder by Marissa Meyer, she talks about Cinder flipping open her index finger and taking out part of a toolkit and things like that.
Yeah, she can open up her own head as well.
Yeah.
And look inside her head. I think she does it at one point and all the other characters are like, oh my god, oh, that's horrible. Why would you do that? Oh. Just casually, like, playing with the wiring in her brain.
Yeah, and she has a motherboard wired up to her brain, so, you know, she can't be deceived. Because the computer's reading everything and saying, no, that's a lie, that's false, it's false information.
Yeah.
So in some ways, like, steampunk is almost the future. I think steampunk is a really important literary genre, at least because it's actually incredibly inclusive. And it continues to be inclusive because it's all about the merger of the best things of the past and the best things of the future.
It's about transition, I think, ultimately, mm-hmm. when you boil it down. It's about transitionary states. I mean, if you look at everything, it sort of takes into account all the things people are asking for more of in fiction now, like gender equality, diversity of race and sexuality, and things like that. You're starting to find more and more of it through modern steampunk. And obviously you've got the whole transition between, you know, steam and new technology and things like that. I don't know if there's an element of the whole steam technology being seen as a bit safer as well.
Yeah, it sort of blends nostalgia and revolution.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In a way where I've seen it referred to before as it's like bringing a flamethrower to a tea party. Yeah. I love that.
On that note, I do want to mention an event that happens every year in Britain. Now, have you ever been to the Whitby Goth Festival?
No.
No, I haven't. There is also the weekend of the Asylum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something to do before you die. Put it on your bucket list.
It is.
Whitby
Both
Goth
of them are.
Festival is brilliant fun, and it's basically split into two camps, if you like, but there's probably a lot of crossover. And you've got, on one side, you've got the people who get really into steampunk and cosplay as steampunk characters, and on the other side, you've got the people doing the more traditional sort of Victorian Dracula type esque dresses and things, and it's an absolute blast. It's just brilliant, and it's the marriage of the old and the new, because the steampunk seems to be sort of like geared at more futuristic steampunk, if you like.
Yeah. I've heard that steampunk was what happened when goths discovered the colour brown.
Yeah. I mean, they call it the Goth Festival, but really it's not just about people getting dressed in black and, you know, painting their faces like lead white or anything.
No.
There's very little of that. And there's the
I've seen pictures. It's very colourful.
It's brilliant. There's the vampire ball in the middle of it, which is all just great fun.
What? This sounds incredible.
Yeah, for the entire weekend, everyone just walks around dressed up.
I always feel sorry for the locals in these areas.
They love it. They join in.
Not they do. Some of them take a long weekend out. You know they do.
Some of them take a long weekend out. Most of them really enjoy it because obviously it brings in a lot of tourism. Whitby's only a very small town. And this ties in with a book I read and reviewed recently, which is The Power of Dark by Robin Jarvis. And he's written about the Whitby witches, which is a creation of his, a trilogy that, you know, dates back to my childhood. So, you know, roughly when the dinosaurs walked the earth. but he's written another book further on from that, and there always has to be a witch in Whitby in order for everything to stay balanced, and there's all sorts of dark things living in Whitby that need to be kept quiet and asleep. And this something is waking up in Whitby, and it's manifesting itself during the Whitby Goth Festival.
So no one notices.
Through the south, through the East Cliff and the West Cliff, and this is where it gets to be like Romeo and Juliet or like West Side Story, and you've got the East Cliff and the West Cliff, and one is steampunk and one is the goth faction, and they go into an epic battle with each other. And it's utterly brilliant. It's hilariously funny if you've been to Whitby Goth Festival as well. So yeah, not really steampunk as a book, but really pays tribute to it.
Well, I think we're coming to the end now.
Yep.
But just to review, so we've had a look at the birth of steampunk. We even know where it originated from as a word. Thank you, Amelia.
You're very welcome.
We looked at traditional steampunk literature, as it is understood now, so H.G. Wells. We didn't talk about Lovecraft, but I don't think he really counts as steampunk. He's just weird.
He sort of inspired some of the tone, yeah, but not necessarily, yeah, the invention.
Yeah, because Cthulhu appears a lot in steampunk. Does, let's not lie.
Yeah. We love our tentacles in steampunk.
You really do. So we talked about that. We talked about steampunk in future settings, including Treasure Island Treasure Planet. Yeah, Treasure Island was not steampunk. And if it was, I really missed some. And the inclusivity of steampunk as a genre and as a way of life, because it is a way of life.
It is, yeah. Having gone storming across Southampton with a group of people in Victorian clothes, in goggles, getting weird looks from the locals. Definitely a way of life.
It's always the goggles as well. Thank you very much for coming onto the show, Amelia.
Thank you for having me.
No, it's been great.
and when Ars Moriendi is published, we will have you back on the show to tell us all about it.
Oh, absolutely.
More so that I can gush about it with someone.
We'll both be just, spoilers, no, wait.
I could gush about this book for a very long time.
Well, I look forward to reading it.
Well, I think that's all. Catch you guys next week.
Thanks and goodbye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.